Founder of The Moth, and I'll be your host. The Moth features true stories, personal stories, told before live audiences. I started The Moth back in 97, and people always want to know where I got the name from. Well, I grew up on an island off the coast of Georgia called St. Simon's, and there's not much to do on St. Simon's Island, so at night we'd go on over to Wanda Bullard's house, which was kind of a ruin. And her porch screens were all bellied out so moths could get in, and they'd go battering around the porch light. And we'd just sit there under all that air traffic and tell stories and drink bourbon. And sometimes we'd drink a lot of bourbon, and the stories would seem to get better as the night wore on. And we started to call ourselves the Moths. And years later, I was at one of those cocktail parties in New York City where you can't finish a story because there are scavengers all around you who are just waiting for you to pause so they can interrupt you. And no one in a New York City cocktail party can hold the floor for more than about 20 seconds, which I thought was kind of sad. So I started The Moth, and we just made people shut up and listen. And we had a string of really amazing evenings. But the night I felt proudest of was when we got Wanda Bullard to come up from Georgia.
And then George made it happen. And he named it The Moth because he said they were like the moth that come to the lights on my porch on Sunday afternoon. And people came like the moth and they listened to stories. So that's why he named it The Moth. And a few years later, he called me up on my promise and said, okay, you promised to come to New York. I had never been to New York then. But I went to New York, and I told a story about my dad. And it got a good reception. Everybody liked my story and seemed like me too. So
here's Wanda Bullard, live at the Moth.
I'm Wanda Bullard. I'm the Wanda Bullard that George Arena is trying to make infamous by telling stories about my house on St. Simon's and my porch that we started telling stories of. But most of what he says is true. So I'm here today to tell you a story about my father, George Bullard. He was born in 1900 in a little bitty area up in the northeast corner of Mississippi that's very rural. Most people would call it hillbilly country. They just call it paradise. So he was one of nine children, and he married when he was 20. He and his wife had two children, and his wife died. So he raised those two daughters, and then when they were grown, he married another woman who turned out to be my mother. She was about 20 years younger than him, and they had two daughters, and I'm the last of the last. He was about 50 years old when I was born, but an incredible influence on my life. And one of the things that he did, mostly what he did to make money, was to raise and train bird dogs that hunted quail. And if the bird dog business got slow, he'd paint a house or two. But when he got late into his 60s, someone talked him into running for office, this bird dog raiser. And he ran for Board of Aldermen, which is like city council. And he was elected. And when he went to the first meeting, he found out that his assignment was that he was the fire commissioner. Now, every previous fire commissioner had gone to meetings and made political decisions and voted and did those kinds of things. But my father didn't quite understand. And so he went down to the fire department and said, now, how am I going to know when there's a fire? And they said, and you need to know, because he said, how else can I know where to go until I know where the fire is? And they said, Mr. Bullard, you intend to go to the fires? Of course, I'm the fire commissioner. They didn't have the heart to tell him that he was taking a step in a new direction from fire commissioner. And so they went along and they hooked the fire department telephone to our telephone at home. I was a teenager. And every time the phone rang at the fire department, it also rang in my house. Not a normal ring, one long, continuous ring until you picked it up. And then you didn't listen. You didn't say anything. You just listened to find out where the fire was. And then my father would hop in his little Datsun station wagon and head for the fire. Now, one downside to it was he didn't see so well at night anymore, so he didn't drive a lot after dark. So as a teenager with a driver's license, my new job was when the fires happened at 2 in the morning, I got to drive him there. I had to keep my jeans and my sneakers by the bed in case of a fire that we had to go help fight. Now, he knew nothing about fighting fires, understand? But he wanted to encourage those young men who were out there doing a valiant job. Well, after serving 2 terms, he was past 70 then, and some people were saying, well, you know, you're still going to go on, and I kind of discouraged it a little bit. He said, okay, he'll let some younger fellow come in and be the fire commissioner. So he stepped down. But he decided, after he kind of retired from being the fire commissioner, that he missed being around the firemen. And Boonville is such a small town that the fire department and the police department are right in the same building. You can walk from one to the other, just between a door. So he'd gotten really close to all the firemen and also the policemen. They kind of considered him like a grandfather. So they tried to figure out how they can keep him hanging around because they loved my father. So they asked him if he wanted a job with the police department. Well, he's 70 years old. He's never done that. He said, sure. What can I do? They said, well, when someone's sick or needs to be off a day, you could come in and fill it on the radio. You could be the dispatcher. Take calls, call out to the cars and tell the policeman where to go, that sort of thing. He said, I can do that. So they actually, I'm never sure how they maneuvered this, they paid him to do this. So he was going along really normal with that job and everything was looking good. And then one day he got to work and found this most amazing thing. They had a prisoner. Now, in all the time he'd been, in the months that he'd been there, they had not had a prisoner. So this intrigued my father. So he'd work on the paperwork a little bit and he'd go back and talk to the prisoner. And by noontime, he was liking this young man, even though he had hair way down here, which my father hated. So when he went out for lunch, he brought the young guy back a couple hamburgers and went back and talked to him some more. And he said, son, why are you in jail? He said, well, I had a little too much to drink last night, Mr. Bullard, and they arrested me for public drunkenness. My father said, well, that's not too bad. Why doesn't somebody come and pay your bail? He said, well, I'm from Corinth, Mississippi. Now, that's about 20 miles up the road from Boonville. He said, I think if I could see my father face to face, he might loan me the $200 to pay my fine, but I'm not sure how he's going to react to a call from the Boonville jail. My dad mulled that over a little bit. He's a real good muller. And he said, you know, if I were to let you go, could you go up to Corinth, find your daddy, borrow the $200 and be back here before my shift ends at 5? The young man was liking the direction of this conversation. He said, Mr. Bullard, I appreciate it, but they impounded my car, so I don't have any way to get to Corinth. It's 20 miles. My daddy said, well, is it a blue Chevrolet? He said, as a matter of fact, it is. He said, oh, it's out in the parking lot. I can find the keys. So with no authority to do anything but talk on the radio, he searched through the desk, found the keys, and not only turned the prisoner loose, gave him a getaway car. About 4 o'clock, the policeman started coming back in off the shift. And they went back to check on their prisoner. They weren't used to having a prisoner either. And they discovered, to their dismay, they didn't have one. And they said to my father, Mr. Bullard, what happened to the prisoner? And very nonchalantly, because he just didn't see that he'd done anything wrong, he said, oh, I turned him loose. You what? I turned him loose. why did you do that? Well, he just seemed like such a nice young man. And I told him he'd need to go get his $200 and come back and pay his fine. They said, well, how's he going to get the car in? He said, oh, I gave him his car. So they're sitting around, mulling around, saying, okay, what are we going to do to make this go away? Because they didn't want my father to be in trouble. They wanted him to be able to continue coming in and hanging out and working on the radio. So they decided, one man said, you know what we'll do? We'll remind the chief of police that George Bullard helped get him elected. Another one said, I got a better idea. Let's just tear up all the paperwork, the arrest report, everything, and let's just pretend none of it ever happened. Now, my father's standing over in the corner listening, and he said, no, we're not going to do either of those things. That young man will be back with the $200. I'm waiting here until he gets here. One policeman observed, it might be a pretty long wait. But my father's thinking about that young man and how they had kind of bonded in those few hours. He remembered telling that young man as he left, now if you can borrow $200 to pay your fine, get a few more and get a darn haircut. That was my own father's only parting advice to him. So the policeman stood around, and 4 o'clock came and went, 4:30, 5 o'clock. No young man. Nobody was surprised except my father. My father said, well, he's just running a little late. And they waited till 5:20, 5:30, and they said, Mr. George, your shift was over at 5. Why don't you go on home? We can take care of this. My father said, didn't I tell you I was waiting until he got back? Yes. So they just started all. The guys that had come in at 4 o'clock wouldn't go home either. Their shift ended. They wouldn't go home. The new guys were coming in. They were trying to fill them in on what was going on. And all of a sudden, strange-looking young man walked through the door, nice clothes, clean-cut, short hair. And he walked up to the counter and he stopped. And nobody paid him any attention. So in a minute, he said, excuse me. And one of the policemen went over and said, can I help you? He said, yes, sir. I'm here to pay my fine. And he said, what fine? Nobody recognized him but my father. And he said, $200. You guys arrested me last night. My fine's $200, so I'm here to pay it. And he's counting out $20 bills. Nobody in the room is making a sound. They're all just in, you know, they're all stunned. Except my father, of course, he knew he was coming back. And they write him out a receipt. And he's looking around the room at all the policemen talking to each other in quiet voices. And he's kind of imagining what the atmosphere was probably like before he returned. So as a parting thought, when he got to the door, he turned around and said to my father, Mr. Bullard, I'm sorry I was late getting back. I had to wait in line at the barber shop.
That was Wanda Bullard. Wanda is a teacher. She teaches emotionally troubled teenagers down in Brunswick, Georgia. And some of these kids are violent, and some of them are twice her size, but they're all under her thumb. They don't give her any trouble, which everyone thinks is kind of miraculous. But Wanda says that she just lets the kids know that she trusts them, which annoys them, of course, because then they have to live up to this trust. But they do that. And that's a trick that I think Wanda learned from her father. When we come back, we'll hear about Andrew Solomon's remedy for depression, which involves 3 kilos of millet, cola beans, a calabash, 7 yards of African fabric, sugar, 2 live roosters, and a ram. So stay tuned for that.
The Moth is supported by Brilliant Earth, offering diamond engagement rings and fine jewelry set with ethically sourced diamonds and a curated collection of vintage jewelry. Dedicated to eco-friendly practices and available at brilliantearth.com. The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by PRX.
This week on This American Life, Josh visits the mean girl he knew in elementary school, And she's still mean.
They look right at you and say, I know you're garbage. You know you're garbage. Why pretend? And you're going to come over to my house, which is the biggest house I've ever seen in my life. And you're going to say, you see this garbage? This is what a real man provides for me.
Some people never get over it. The allure of the mean friend.
You know, you come here and you tape me for your stupid friend's radio show, and then you get the hell out.
Saturdays at noon on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, roasting coffee daily at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Also offering a variety of tea and chai. Open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5:15 p.m. and Saturday mornings from 9 to noon. More information is available at 352-9713.
I'm George Dawes Green, and this is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. Our next story is from Andrew Solomon. His most recent book was The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression. It won the 2001 National Book Award. Andrew told this story at a Moth in New York City.
So I'm not depressed now, but I was depressed for a long time, and I wrote about being depressed, and I lived for a long time with blinding depression and had long stretches when everything seemed hopeless and pointless, when returning calls from friends seemed like more than I could do, when getting up and going out into the world seemed painful, when I was completely crippled with anxiety. And when I finally got better and started writing about the process of recovery, I became very interested in all of the different kinds of treatment that there were for depression. And having started as a kind of medical conservative, thinking that there were only a couple of things that worked, medication and certain talking therapies, and that was really it, I very gradually began to change my mind, because I realized that if you have brain cancer and you decide that standing on your head and gargling for half an hour every day makes you feel better, it may make you feel better, but the likelihood is that you still have brain cancer and you're still going to die from it. But if you have depression and you say that standing on your head and gargling for half an hour makes you feel better, then you are actually cured, because depression is an illness of how you feel. And if you feel really great after you do that, then you're not depressed anymore. So I began to think all kinds of things could work. And I researched everything ranging from experimental brain surgeries to hypnotic regimens of various kinds. I had people writing to me because I had been publishing on this subject. There was one woman who wrote to me, and she said that she had tried actually electroshock treatments and a variety of other approaches to depression, medication, and therapy, and she had finally found the thing that worked for her, and she wanted me to tell the world about it, and that was making little things from yarn. some of which she sent me. And none of which I'm wearing right now. But in any event, I had that rich engagement. And I also became interested, as I was doing this work, in the idea that depression existed not only in the civilized West, as people tended to perceive it to exist, but actually across cultures and had existed across time. And so when one of my dearest friends, my friend David Hecht, who was living for a little while in Senegal, said to me, "Do you know about the tribal rituals that are used for the treatment of depression here?" I said, "No, I don't know about them, but I would like to know about them." And he said, "Well, if you come for a visit, we could try to do some research on this topic." And so I set off for Senegal, and I met David. And it turned out that Hélène had a cousin whose mother was a friend of someone who went to school with the daughter of a person who actually practiced the Ndop, and that I could therefore go and interview this woman who had practiced the Ndop. And so we went off to a small town about 2 hours outside of Dakar, and I was introduced to this extraordinary, old, large woman wrapped in miles and miles of African fabric printed with figures of eyes. And she was Madame Diouf, and we did an interview for about an hour, and she told me all about the Undop. And at the end of it, feeling rather daring, I said, listen, I said, I don't know whether this is something you would even consider, I said, but would it be possible for me to attend an Undop? And she said, well, I've certainly never had a foreigner, the local word was tubob, I've never had a foreigner attend one of these before, she said, but actually, she said, I mean, you've come through these friends and these connections, she said, yes, the next time I perform an Undop, you may be present. And I said, that's fantastic. I said, when are you next going to be doing an Undop? And she said, oh, it'll be sometime in the next 6 months. And I said, 6 months is quite a long time for me to stay here in this town waiting for you to do one. I said, is there anyone who might, maybe we could expedite one for somebody, move it forward, I'll pitch in. She said, no, it really doesn't work that way. She said, I'm sorry, but that's how it is. And I said, well, I guess I won't be able to see an Undop then, but even so, this conversation has been so interesting and so helpful to me, and I'm a little sad leaving here about not actually getting to see one, but I thank you. And she said, well, I'm glad that you could come. I'm glad it was helpful. And she said, but there is one other thing. She said, I hope you don't mind my saying this. And I said, well, no, what? What is it? And she said, you don't look that great yourself. She said, are you suffering from depression? And I said, well, yes. I said, I was very acute. It's kind of a little better now, but yeah, I still do actually suffer from depression. She said, well, I've certainly never done this for a tubob before, but I could actually do an Undop for you. And I said, oh. I said, what an interesting idea. I said, well, yes, sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yes, let's do that. I said, then I'll have an Undop. And she said, oh, well, that's great, she said. And she gave us some sort of fairly basic instructions, and then we left. And my translator, the aforementioned then-girlfriend, now ex-wife of my friend, turned to me and she said, are you completely crazy? Do you have any idea what you're getting yourself into? And I said, well, you know, I'm all these things, very interesting. She said, you're crazy. She said, you're totally crazy, but I'll help you if you want. So we had left, and the first thing we had was a shopping list. There had been you could get them to buy the stuff, but you had to pay a surcharge. I'd said, no, we'd buy the stuff. So we had to go out. We had to buy 7 yards of African fabric. We had to get a calabash, which was a large bowl fashioned from a gourd. We had to get 3 kilos of millet. We had to get sugar. We had to get kola beans. And then we had to get 2 live cockerels, 2 roosters, and a ram. And so Hélène and I went to the market with David and with these other people, and we got most of the things. And I said, well, but what about the ram? And Hélène said, we can't buy the ram today. What are we going to do with it overnight? So I saw the sense of that. So the next day, we got into a taxi to go back out 2 hours to where we were going. And I said, what about the ram? And Hélène said, oh, we'll see a ram along the way. So we were going along, and there was a Senegalese shepherd by the side of the road with his flock, and we stopped the cab, and we got out, and we bought the ram for $7, and then we had a little bit of a struggle getting the live ram into the trunk of the taxi cab. But the cab driver seemed not at all worried, even by the fact that the ram kept relieving himself in the trunk of the taxi cab. And so then we got to Rufisque, and we got there. So, well, here I am. I'm ready for my close-up. And the thing about the Undop is that it varies enormously depending on a whole variety of signals and symbols that come from above. So we had to go through this whole shamanistic process, and I still didn't know really very much of what was going to happen. So first I had to change out of my jeans and my t-shirt and put on a loincloth, and then I sat down, and then I had my chest and my arms rubbed with millet, and then which is a grain, and then someone said, oh, we really should have music for this. And I said, oh, great. And I thought, you know, drumming, I thought some atmospheric thing. And she came out with her very prized possession, which was a battery-operated tape player for which she had one tape, which was Chariots of Fire. So we started listening to Chariots of Fire, and in the meanwhile, I was given sort of various shamanistic objects. I had to hold them with my hands and drop them. I had to hold them with my feet and drop them. They would sort of say, oh, this augurs well, this augurs badly. There were five assistants to Madame Diouf who had all gathered around. And we sort of spent the morning like this, and it was all really just fine. And then they said it was maybe, we'd started at about 8, maybe about 11, 11:30. They said, well, now it's actually time for the central part of the ritual. And I said, oh, okay. And this sound of drumming began, the drumming I'd been hoping for, the drumming began. And so there was all of this drumming, and it was very exciting. And we went to the central square of the village, where there was a small makeshift wedding bed that I had to get into with the ram. And I had been told it would be very, very bad luck if the ram escaped, and that I had to hold on to him, and that the reason we had to be in this wedding bed was that all my depression and all my problems were caused by the fact that I had spirits. In Senegal, you have spirits sort of all over you, the way here you sort of have microbes. Some are good for you, some are bad for you, some are neutral. Anyway, my bad spirits were extremely jealous of my real-life sexual partners, some of whom are here tonight. And and that we had to mollify the anger of the spirit. So I had to get into this wedding bed with the ram, and I had to hold the ram very tightly because he was not having a good life, this ram. And he, of course, immediately relieved himself on my leg. And the entire village had taken the day off from their work in the fields and were dancing around us in concentric circles. And as they danced, throwing blankets and sheets of cloth over us. And so we were gradually being buried, and it was unbelievably hot, and it was completely stifling, and there was the sound of these stamping feet as everyone danced around us, and then these drums, which were getting louder and louder and more ecstatic and more ecstatic, and I was just about at the point at which I thought I was going to faint or pass out. At that key moment, suddenly all of the cloths were pulled off. I was yanked to my feet. The loincloth that was all I was wearing was pulled from me. The poor old ram's throat was slit, as were the throats of the two cockerels, and I was covered in the blood of the freshly slaughtered ram and the cockerels. And so there I was, naked, totally covered in blood, and they said, okay, that's the end of this part of it. And I said, well, okay. And they said, they said, the next piece comes now. And I said, okay. And we went over back to the area where we'd done the morning preparations. And one of them said, but look, it's kind of lunchtime. Why don't we just take a break for a minute? Would you like a Coke? I don't drink Coke that much, but at that moment, it seemed like a really, really, really good idea. And I said, yes. And so I sat there naked and completely covered in animal blood, with flies kind of gathering as they will when you're naked and covered in animal blood. And I drank this Coke. And then when I had finished the Coke, they said, okay, now we have the sort of final parts of the ritual. They said, so first you have to put your hands by your sides and hold your stand very straight and very erect. And I said, oh, okay. And then they tied me up with the intestines of the ram. And in the meanwhile, it was hanging from a nearby tree, and there was someone sort of doing some butchering of it, and they took various little bits of it out. And then I had to kind of shuffle over, all tied up in intestines, which most of you probably haven't done, but it's hard. I had to shuffle over, and I had to take these little pieces of the ram, and I had to dig holes, and I had to put the pieces of the ram in the holes. And I had to say something, and what I had to say was actually, to me, incredibly, strangely touching in the middle of this weird experience. I had to say, spirits, leave me alone to complete the business of my life, and know that I will never forget you. And I thought, what a kind thing to say to the evil spirits you're exercising, that I'll never forget you, and I haven't. So anyway, there were various other little bits and pieces that followed. I was given a piece of paper in which all of the millet from the morning had been gathered. I was told that the next morning I should sleep with it under my pillow and in the morning get up and give it to a beggar who had good hearing and no deformities, and that when I gave it to him, that would be the end of my troubles. And then the women sort of all filled their mouths with water and began spitting water all over me, which it turns out is the sort of, you know, it's the surround shower effect, and rinsing the blood away from me. And it gradually came off, and when I was clean, they gave me back my jeans, and everyone danced, and they barbecued the ram, and we had this dinner, and I felt so up. I felt so up. It had been quite an astonishing experience, even though I didn't believe in the animist principles behind it. All of these people had been gathered together cheering for me, and it was very exhilarating. And I had a very odd experience 5 years later when I was working on my current book, and I was in Rwanda doing something else altogether, and I got into a conversation with someone there. And I described the experience I'd had in Senegal. And he said, oh, you know, we have something that's a little like that. He said, that's West Africa. This is East Africa. It's quite different. But there are some similarities in some rituals here. He said, you know, we had a lot of trouble with Western mental health workers who came here immediately after the genocide. And we had to ask some of them to leave. And I said, what was the problem? And he said, okay, they came and their practice did not involve being outside in the sun like what you're describing, which is, after all, where you begin to feel better. There was no music or drumming to get your blood flowing again when you're depressed and you're low and you need to have your blood flowing. He said there was no sense that everyone had taken the day off so that the entire community could come together to try to lift you up and bring you back to joy. He said there was no acknowledgement of the depression as something invasive and external that could actually be cast out of you again. He said instead they would take people one at a time into these dingy little rooms and have them sit around for an hour or so and talk about bad things that had happened to them. He said, we had to get them to leave the country. Thank you.
Andrew Solomon writes for the New York Times and the New Yorker, among many other publications. He's at work now on a book entitled A Dozen Kinds of Love, Raising Challenging Children, and he's a favorite of ours. We have just a few rules at the Moth. One is that you can't bring a script up on stage with you. The stories need to seem fresh, like they're being cooked up as you're serving them. And they have to be true. Though, of course, any good story as it's told and retold might pick up a few inaccuracies along the way. But there's something about a Moth evening. Though a story may stray from the literal truth, if we're having a good time, there's such a glow that somehow the errors are burned away and the perfect truth is restored to us. Yes, it is. We'll come right back to hear novelist Richard Price tell us about cruising in the back of a police car through the East Village of New York.
The Moth is supported by Makers 46, handcrafted bourbon finished in barrels with seared French oak staves, online at makers46.com. Makers 46 bourbon whiskey, 47% alcohol by volume, distilled in Loretto, Kentucky, reminds listeners to drink responsibly. The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by PRX.
On the next Fresh Air, historian Rick Perlstein, the author of Nixonland, talks about his new book in his series on the rise of American conservatism. It's called An Invisible Bridge, and it explains the rise of Ronald Reagan amid the turbulent events of the mid-70s, from Watergate and the fall of Saigon to gas lines and the Symbionese Liberation Army. Join us.
Weekday mornings at 11 and again at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
This is the Moth Radio Hour, and I'm George Dawes Green. Some years ago, a bunch of us writers were at a bar in the Lower East Side of New York, and we were lamenting the death of the authentic Lower East Side since it's been overrun by yuppies and faux artists and would-be screenwriters. And we thought, now there'll be no more great stories coming out of this neighborhood. And while we were sitting there moaning, Richard Price was out cruising in the back of a police car all around us, and he would soon produce a novel, Lush Life, in which one of the main characters is a would-be screenwriter. And the novel is mesmerizing, and the Lower East Side is an incandescent setting. And how did he do this? How did he find such passionate stories in a neighborhood that everyone said had become banal and dry and spiritless? Well, he's a brilliant writer, and he opened his eyes and he listened. And the stories are always there. And one of those stories he shared with us at a Moth in New York City.
Okay, there's three things I should say. My three favorite sayings is God is a first-rate novelist, God is a second-rate novelist, and the fact that something really happened is the defense of the mediocre novelist. In the last novel I wrote, I spent a lot of time on the Lower East Side, and as is my wont, I wound up in the back of police cars a lot. And Lower East Side is a very low-crime area right now. It used to be the worst, but Giuliani and real estate pressure took care of that. And now they basically have nothing to do down there in terms of crime. So what they do is they sort of sit in fake taxis, you know, four beefy white guys sit in a fake taxi by the side of Williamsburg Bridge, and they eyeball what's coming over from Brooklyn. And if the car looks like a $200 shit box or somebody's got an afro or a ponytail, they pull in behind the car and they wait to see if the guy's going to go all polite in his driving, like put on lane change signals, then they know he's dirty. and, you know, so worst comes to worst, you know, it's fishing, really. It's a big fishing hole, Delancey Street. And so I spent all night in this bogus taxi with about, you know, 850 pounds of white beef. And it's the end of the night. They you know, they made their, like, you know, collars. There are two cops up front, and I'm sitting in the back. And when I ride with these guys, I don't really comment about what they do. I don't engage them, you know, in any kind of debates. It's like I'm there to bear witness and then see what I can do with it, you know, in my work. Anyways, they're riding up Essex Street. It's kind of Miller time, you know, and... And as they're going up, they pass a black guy about 30 years old with dreads on a bicycle. And on the crossbars, he's got a white kid about 9, 10 years old. And the black guy and the white kid, they're kind of chatting. The kid's looking up at the guy. You know, they look like they're sort of familiar with each other. And the cops drive by, and they're dead silent. After about a block, one guy says to the other, he says, "Hey, big guy, does that look fishy to you?" He says, "It's midnight. What's going on here?" He says, "Well, what do you want to do, big guy?" So I'll tell you, big guy. All right, make the light, you know, pull over. Let's see what's what. So they pull over. Bike's coming up Essex. One of the cops steps in the road, puts his hand down, says, "Hey, how you doing? Get off the bike, please." You know, and the black guy gets off the bike, and he goes, "Hey, officers," you know, like it's an unexpected treat. You know, "Hi, you know, what's up?" And, he says, "Do you ever hear of helmets?" "Oh, yeah, gee, I'm really sorry." At which point, the other cop says to the little white kid, says, "Hey, big guy, what's your name?" He goes, "Noah Rosenberg," you know, like he's not sure. He says, "Hey, Noah, come here, buddy. Come on over here." And he separates the two, and I'm sort of hopping in between the two conversations at this point. And the black guy tries to follow the white kid, and the other cop puts his hand on his chest, and he says, "No, you stay over here. Let me see some ID." He says, "What?" He says, "Some ID." He says, "Don't look at him. Look at me." He says, No, I was just picking him up from a play date. "Did I ask you that?" No, you don't understand. I worked the bar at Schiller's, and, you know, again, did I ask you that?" "Well, no." He says, "Why are you trying to divert me?" He says, "I'm not. Go down the same road as me." He goes, okay. And he gives him the ID, and at which point he sort of waves to the kid, and he goes, "Oh, what did I just say to you?" He says, no, I'm really sorry. It's Noah. He's, you know, he's kind of wound a little tight." And he says, "Oh, really?" He says, "Have a seat." He points to the curb, and he makes the guy sit on the curb with his feet in the gutter. And he says, "So where are you going?" He says, "Well, I had the late shift." And he says, "It's kind of late to be driving around with a kid on a bike, isn't it?" At which point I leave those two, and I go over to Noah and the other cop. And he says, "So your name's Noah, huh?" And the kid says, "Yes, and for the millionth time, I don't have an arc." And, the cop says, "Well, you must get that a lot." And the kid says, "Oh, my God, you have no idea." And he says, "So, Noah, how old are you?" He says, "Well, next week I'll be a decade old." I said, "Well, that's great. And where do you live?" He says, 333 Avenue B. He says, "And you go to school around here?" He says, "Yes, I go to the Earth School." And he says, "Oh, cool. And who do you live with?" He says, "I live with my mom." And she goes, "And who's that over there?" He says, "Well, I don't know who your friend is, but my friend is Cleve." And he says, "Oh, do you know what Cleve's last name is?" He says, "Yeah, Carter. Cleve Carter. Sometimes I call him Coca-Cola. Sometimes I call him Carbon Copy." He says, "Oh." He says, "Do you know him for long?" I said, "Well, yeah, like one and a quarter years. He's kind of like my godfather since my other godfather died." "Oh, and what do you guys do?" "Well, he was taking me home from a play date to my mom." He says, "So he knows your mom?" And he says, "Well, yeah, he and my mom are kind of like friends." He says, "Kind of like?" He says, "Well, they have like sleepover dates." And he says, "So your mom knows that you're with him now?" She says, "Well, my mom sent him to pick me up. My dad lives in Woodstock." So, okay, at which point I'm going, okay, let's see what's happening with Cleve. I walk over there, Cleve's sitting on the curb, and he's got his feet out there, and he's trying to make it look like it's natural. So he's like massaging his like deep thigh muscles, like he's limbering up for the marathon or something. You know, it's just humiliating. You know, and he's kind of smiling because you can't win. You gotta like play through, you know. And he's sitting there, and the other cop is hitting his driver's license with a mag light, one of those big, powerful flashlights, and he goes, "So, Cleveland, I see you're from Ohio." And he says, "Yeah." He says, "Cleveland from Ohio?" He says, well, actually, it's from Oxford." And the guy goes, "Oh, Miami College." And he goes, yeah, that's where I went." And the cop goes, "Oh, Wally Szczerbiak," who's this big basketball player. And he goes, "Well, yeah, Wally was a little before my time." "So, did you play ball for them too?" He said, "Well, not basketball. I played soccer." I said, "Oh, that's amazing, because I teach soccer. I coach soccer out on the island, you know, in a kids' league." You know, and he says, "You know, that's amazing. I keep waiting for that sport to blow up, but I don't think it's, you know." And Cleveland's going, yeah, that's amazing. You know, he's sitting, you know, just wiping his off his pants. At which point, a Mustang comes by with two black guys in it and up Essex. And the guy in the shotgun seat looks out the windows, and he sees Cleveland sitting on the curb. And he starts yelling out, "Homeboy to base, homeboy to base, we got a black man down. I repeat, a black man down." And he's like laughing his ass off, and the Mustang floors it. You know, and Cleveland's kind of squinting, and he's kind of looking the other way. He's just like mortified, you know. And then hopping back to the other cop with the kid, and he says, "So Noah, does Cleveland live with you?" He goes, "No, Cleveland lives at 444 Avenue D. We live at 332 Avenue B. He says, "Well, yeah, you ever been over to his house?" He says, "Only about a million times." And he says, "Mostly with your mom, I guess, huh?" He says, "And by myself." He said, "Oh, really? What do you do there?" He says, "Well, you know, sometimes we walk his dog. It's a Rhodesian Ridgeback named Mars. And one time he tried to teach me how to make scrambled eggs, but I don't really like his oven because you light the pilot match and it goes, you know, and it scares me." And he says, "One time, you know, my mom had to go to court in Woodstock, and I stayed with Cleveland for 3 days." And he said, "In court, huh?" He said, "Yeah, 3 days?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "But mostly, I'd say 82.5% of the time we watch television, you and Cleveland." He said, "Yeah, me and Cleve." He goes, and the cop said to him, "Do you ever do anything else with him?" And he goes, What do you mean?" He goes, "Do you do anything else with him?" And all of a sudden, the kid's eyes get really big and kind of like wet, like steel. And the kid starts kind of like breathing kind of heavy, and the cop starts shaking a little bit. And the cop says to him, he says, "Hey, Noah, look at this." And he pulls his jacket back and he shows him this, his detective shield on his belt. He says, "You know what that is?" He says, "Yeah, it's a police badge." He says, "You know what this means?" He says, "What?" He says, "That means you can tell me anything you want and you'll be perfectly safe. Do you understand that?" And the kid looks at him and he goes, "Oh my God, are you going to arrest him?" And the cop, his heart's pumping Kool-Aid, and he starts moving over, and he says, "Why?" And the kid goes, "If you f***ers arrest him again one more time just because he's black and I'm not, I'm going to kill myself. You came into my apartment and dragged him out because the crazy lady next door said he was a rapist. You put him in handcuffs when he came to pick me up at school. You pulled him away from me at the street fair and had made me wait for my mom. I says, I swear to God, I'm going to lose my mind." You know, and the cops go, "Whoa, easy, easy, easy." At which point, both cops are looking at each other like, "Well, what's going on?" And all of a sudden, Cleveland sees the kids losing it, and he goes, "Hey, Noah, buddy." And the cop goes, "What did I just say to you? Stop talking to the kid." And at which point, Cleveland says, "Officer, you want to put this to rest? I tell you what, I'm reaching for my cell phone in here." He says, why don't you call the kid's mom and, you know, just see what's going on?" He says, "I'll call the kid's mom." He says, "What's her name?" She goes, "Adina." And he calls across to the other cop, "Get the kid's mother's name." And the kid, through sobs, is going, "Adina." And Cleveland gives the cop the mother's number. The cop calls, and he says, "Hey, how you doing? This is Sergeant Daly from the 7th Precinct. Who am I speaking to?" And she goes, "Oh, my God, Adina Rosenberg, what happened?" He goes, nothing happened. I just need to know. Do you know where your son is right now?" At which point she freaks. And she goes, "Where is he? What happened? He's supposed to be with Cleveland. He's supposed to be taking him home from a play date. What happened? What happened? What happened?" "Well, no, he's fine." "Okay." At which point the kid goes, "My mom says if I get any more nervous, I'm going to have to live with my father in Woodstock, you f-." You know, and the cop's going, you know, and the cop's going, no, the kid's great. The kid's fine. You know, it's this, the only thing is like they were riding without helmets, you know, and it's a serious safety violation. And she's going, "Oh, my God. Oh, Jesus." She says, no, okay, don't worry about it. All right, good night, have a good night, you know, and hangs up. At which point they bring Cleveland and Noah together again, and they give him this half-ass lecture on bicycle safety. And he says, "You know, I'm supposed to write you up, but, you know, I'm going to give you a pass this time." And, you know, Cleveland's still kind of smiling, but the smile doesn't go past here. You know, it never reaches his eyes. And he gets back on the bike, and the kid gets on the handlebars, and the kid's going through that, you know, post-crying jag, you know, shudder withdrawal. And Cleveland's kind of talking him down as he sort of pushes off, and they go disappear up Essex. And we get back in the police car, and I'm sitting in the back, and I'm not saying a f***ing thing. And they go in dead silence for about two blocks. And one cop finally says to the other, he says, "You know something, big guy?" And the other guy says, "What's that, big guy?" He says, "Still feels fishy to me." And the other cop says, "Hey, we gave it a shot, man. That's all we can do. Thank you."
That was Richard Price. He's written many novels, including The Wanderers, Blood Brothers, Clockers, Freedom Land, and the book he was researching in the back of that police car, Lush Life. If you want to hear more Moth stories, visit our website, themoth.org, to sign up for our free weekly podcast. You can also find many more Moth stories at the iTunes Store. Do you have a Moth story? Call our story pitch hotline at 877-799-MOTH. That's 877-799-6684 to leave a one-minute message. Last season, we asked for your pitches, and we heard from many of you. Here's a bit from a pitch we liked.
"It was the third time the phone had rang in the last 40 minutes. This time it was Habib. 'Mr. Chen,' he said in English. Habib's accent is so thick that even when you know what he's saying, it's difficult to understand him. I caught snippets. It was something like, 'Important man, tonight, must see him.' I said yes, And before I had even put the phone back in its cradle, there was a knock on the door. It was 1 o'clock in the morning. I was in my underwear. And before I could say, come in or hold on or anything like that, the door burst open and there were two guys with machine guns inside my hotel room.
You can log on to themoth.org and record a story pitch right on the web. That's themoth.org. That's all we have time for on the Moth Radio Hour. Thanks so much for tuning in. Your host this week was George Dawes Green, the founder of The Moth and Unchained. He's also the author of the novels Ravens, The Juror, and The Caveman's Valentine. Wanda Bullard, whose story you heard first in this hour, passed away in 2011. The Moth misses her dearly. The stories in this hour were directed by Catherine Burns and Joey Zanders. The rest of the Moth's directorial staff includes Sarah Haberman, Sarah Austin Jeunesse, Jennifer Hickson, and Meg Bowles. Production support from Jenna Weiss-Berman and Brandon Echter.
All right, so are all the storytellers whose names were called out ready to go, ready to bring it to the stage, and they are going to tell us the first line of the stories that they so sweetly prepared for us that we did not get to hear.
Moth stories are true, as remembered and affirmed by the storytellers. Moth events are recorded by Argo Studios in New York City, supervised by Paul Ruest.
It was 5 months after the incident before I could bring myself to clean the flesh and the fur from the blade of my chainsaw.
Our theme music is by The Drift. Other music in this hour from Three Leg Torso, Ali Farka Torres.